again and welcome to another episode of Voices from SA. My name is Nicholas Claude. I hope you're keeping well and staying healthy. Please remember to wash your hands regularly, wear a face mask in public, observe social distancing, and remain quarantined as much as possible. Please be aware of COVID-19 protocols wherever you are living, because these change obviously from country to country. Having said all that, and having been very disciplined myself during lockdown, I contracted coronavirus a few weeks ago. I was asymptomatic though, and am out of my 2 weeks isolation, but monitoring my health for any side effects. But it just goes to show it's a difficult virus to combat and contain. My guest this week is Edgar Peterson. He's the director of the African Center for Cities based at the University of Cape Town. He describes himself as an urbanist. He has a background in sociology, but his work these days straddles the economics, politics, and geography of urbanization in Africa, and South Africa in particular. We covered a range of topics around the phenomenon of urbanization and the role of cities as the hubs of modern industrial society. We discussed the often difficult relationship between large city governments and national governments and the struggle for policy and financial control across sub-Saharan Africa. Edgar feels it's necessary for the socio-political and economic debate at all levels to be reimagined if cities are to fulfill their true potential of economic growth, or hubs of engines of economic growth and transformation. The bulk of our discussion focused on the Integration Syndicate project that was hosted by the ACC a few years back. The project is an attempt to encourage a different kind of thinking about the issues of urbanization in Cape Town and explores the obstacles and solutions to social spatial integration in Cape Town. The five provocations that came out of the sessions are relevant to any large city, and we touched a bit on those during our discussion. Edgar says one of his aims is to create some coherence around the chaotic process of urbanization on the continent, and I hope now that you enjoy our discussion. Edgar,
sure.
Thanks for your time. Let's get cracking. I've seen you described as an urban sociologist. You're the director of the African Center for Cities. Does urban sociologist is that the way to describe you?
I have no idea. I prefer to just use the word urbanist, because no one knows what that means, and it is vague enough to kind of fit with what people's expectations may be.
Get you through any doors you need to get through, I suppose.
Yeah, and part of it is because my training has been very varied. So I started off, you know, with a very general BA degree, and I did do my honours in sociology at UWC.
Right.
But I then went on to do a development studies master's, and that was, you know, really interdisciplinary with a more of an economics bent.
Right.
And then my PhD was, you know, a hybrid of planning and social policy, which is technically where I was registered at LSC, and geography. So yeah, urbanist is just, you know, the easiest and most convenient descriptor to hide my eternal confusion about who I am and what I do.
That's quite a potpourri, but a beautiful potpourri. I mean, of the economics, the geographist, the sociologist, and I suppose it does explain. You know, just when I read your bio, I don't want to list too many things about that I want to discuss with you, because often what happens is I don't get to cover them, and it becomes a sort of bit of a frustration, I think, for the listener. But if you could, let's start, because that's a perfect little summary, and that's a nice starting point for us. If we could just jump straight into the African Center for Cities, if you could just tell us a little bit about the African Center for Cities, what it is you do at the African Center for Cities yourself, and what the purpose of the center is.
Sure. So in 2005, 2006, a group of academics at UCT, including people like Vanessa Watson and Sue Parnell and others, felt that it was really important for UCT to reclaim and reformulate its urban research capacity. Some people may recall that there was a very important institution there called the Urban Problems Research Unit that Dave Dewar in particular was very influential in since the early 70s. And that documented and chronicled the sort of heyday of the Group Areas Act and the establishment of the townships like Mitchell's Plain and Khayelitsha and so forth in the Cape Town context. But that was closed down for a variety of reasons in the early 90s. And, you know, and that left an enormous void. And, of course, by 2004-05, it was clear that UCT had to reconnect with the African continent. And one of the main meta trends, of course, was kind of this dramatic unfolding of urbanization. Yeah. And so there was a collective of people who started a conversation about the need for UCT to establish capacity to work in this space. I was part of that conversation, even though I wasn't formally at UCT. I was just teaching there part-time. And then in 2006/07, the university got a small grant from the O of Arab Foundation to start a new master's program to basically help engineers and people who are in technical professions to have a broader understanding of urban questions. And part of that discussion then was also to really accelerate the establishment of this research center. And then I was asked to essentially come to UCT and do the establishment work. On the back of some seed finance that the university had put up through something called the Signature Theme Funding, and then also to very much be part of the fundraising efforts that was led by the then Dean and Vanessa Watson. So yeah, so that's the genesis of it. But from the beginning, we were really keen to do something that was truly interdisciplinary between faculties, but worked in a very deep and meaningful way in our own backyard. And that meant working with the public sector and civil society in Cape Town, and I can say a little bit more about that. But at the same time, we wanted to really reconnect with African universities on the continent. And we also wanted to be a voice for urban studies from the Global South in international debates. And in the academy, unfortunately, the question of cities, of urbanization, and broadly speaking, the phenomena of urbanism remains, you know, predominantly a sort of a northern intellectual affair. And the number of scholars who shape that debate from the Global South is very small. And so we really wanted to intervene in that. So we do all of that. We do very, very deep applied research in Cape Town. We work with university partners on the continent, and we contribute to international discussions about the changing nature of cities and urbanism. And part of my job is to create a narrative that suggests that these things are all totally coherent and that they add up as an institutional form. But to be honest, it's been all a wild experiment for the last 12 years. And, you know, and we completely adapting all the time. Yeah, so I'm happy to elaborate on anything more specific you want to know more about.
No, certainly. I mean, there's so much to get my head around. One of the terms I've seen, I mean, as you say, trying to sort of develop some sort of coherent view of what is such a chaotic process, urbanization itself, and the way cities, city governments react or try and facilitate, react to or facilitate or to or facilitate that process is so, it seems, individual. I mean, you say you're obviously you're based in Cape Town, your research focus is Cape Town. You do mention Johannesburg, but I suppose those are two such different cities in the South African context, and then you'd look at Cape Town to Cairo as being sort of African cities dealing with massive or differing types of urbanization. How do you try and get coherence out of this quite tumultuous process of that we call, well, maybe define how you see urbanization and how then you get coherence of that process?
Sure. So one of the challenges we face is that there are lots of myths about urbanization. And politically, especially in the African continent, but not uniquely so, politicians dislike it at sort of a visceral level, you know, because they see cities as these messy, chaotic things that they can't control, and they're afraid of that. And so what we've seen, for example, in as recent as 2012, you know, more than 80% of African governments, for example, had active legislation on their books to prevent rural to urban migration, almost criminalize it in some form. Because there's this idea that urbanization, you know, equates chaos, that it is, it represents vice. And of course, one of the subtexts is that if you look at the multi-party democracy experiment in the African continent over the last 20 years, is you will see that opposition political parties find a foothold in the cities first. And so the subtext here is that the longer you can keep people in rural areas, the better it is for the former liberation movement political parties. Because, you know, the liberation struggle and freedom from colonialism was always equated with this notion of a return to the land, that the land will be returned back to its rightful owners. But of course, within that imagination, the land is rural land. It is about agricultural existence. It's right. about a pre-urban identity.
It's not the city.
It's not the city. And, you know, the city is equated with this idea of modernity, with the European identity, with everything that's alien, that stripped us from who we are. And so this operates at a sort of DNA level of modern African governments who hold the inheritance of the anti-colonial struggles and the post-colonial statecraft project. And so there's this generalized, if you will, antipathy and skepticism about the city and what it holds. And of course, as I said before, you know, this is indeed where opposition political parties find a foothold and where they typically build their base. And so practically what this has meant is that outside of South Africa, in most of sub-Saharan Africa, local governments and city governments in particular have very, very few powers. Everything gets done by the national government, and national utilities provide basic services. Furthermore, city governments can't even raise their own revenue. So that is more or less the status quo. So part of what we've got to do is to try and build an evidence-based narrative about why urbanization is absolutely fundamental to the larger African Renaissance project, if you will. Why you can't have inclusive economic development without thriving cities. And that right. means that you have to become much more open-minded and mature about how you organize your relations between the different levels of government, national, regional, or provincial, and local. And within that, you have to give cities the authority to, if you will, imagine their futures and to position themselves, because of course, city economies are part of global value chains. And unless city authorities have the levers at their disposal to optimize their comparative advantages, they will really struggle to grow their economies in a sustainable and in an inclusive manner. So that's the work that we've been trying to do in many different formats. It's tough work because they can see the argument if you put the economic spin on it. But of course, politically, it's not particularly palatable. And this is a constant struggle. And I'll just give you one example to illustrate it, and then I'll stop talking. In 2013, the AU adopted a charter that, if you will, indicates that decentralization of power and devolution is a good thing, it's a necessary thing. Since the majority of African countries who were part of that General Council adopted this resolution, you know, you kind of felt that you won a major political achievement here.
Yeah.
But in 2020, as we speak, July 2020, only four African governments have ratified that convention. So that, you know, that tells the whole story about the lack of political interest to really empower cities to take the lead in figuring out their destinies and to deal with their problems. I don't want to sort of get too detailed, but just to sort of illustrate some of the issues there.
Look, this conversation will take its own course, and you know what, I'll react as we go to what you say. So that now has made me think: is there almost a concerted effort, or rather just a sort of almost willful ignorance, or a concerted effort to make cities unattractive?
No, I wouldn't say that. It's more of a, it's more of a political reflex, right? So of course, sort of national governments and the political parties that control the polity or that sits behind that, you know, their core interest is to remain in control. So they don't want to lose control. But at the same time, they recognize that as African economies become part of global systems and flows, there's certain fundamentals that have to be in place. Your infrastructure has got to happen. It's got to be there. Yep. Your broadband has got to be upgraded and expanded. You've got to have ports and airports that are efficient, et cetera, et cetera. And the tension they face is that often a lot of these infrastructural services that lubricate the economy are anchored in the big cities. You know, right. And so you need government agencies who have the authority to manage that effectively. And that's where the rub lies.
At the city level.
The city level. Right. They try and delay that devolution of authority to cities as long as possible and hold on to control at the national level. And that sets up a tension. And then it also makes it very difficult for investors and others to make sense of this dynamic and actually feel that there's sufficient certainty here, both politically and in policy terms, to put our investment capital in. So that's sort of the story. So it's more dialectical. It's more tension driven. I wouldn't say that they would intentionally undermine cities, but they would sort of grudgingly devolve certain authority and power and control in order to achieve larger national objectives. But it is, you know, it is always a struggle, and it is highly contested.
It's a sort of a fear of this of a successful city government stealing the national government's thunder, I suppose, in that kind of context.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So again, I must just underscore, this is much more of a dynamic in sub-Saharan Africa, outside of South Africa, because our constitution guarantees, sort of enormous autonomy and fiscal control to our local authorities and city governments. We've got a different dynamic in South Africa, but you know, for your listeners, just to sort of sketch that context.
Cool.
Yeah.
No, thanks. No, I've traveled, I've visited many cities, many large cities, some of the largest cities in the world, Beijing, Sao Paulo, Mexico City, just for days, of course, not for lengthy periods. And then I've lived in small cities like Durban and Stockholm in Sweden. And, you know, I was just in thinking about our discussion, how the city has become the kind of fundamental machine of our industrial societies. Is that a correct way to assess the city?
Yeah, no, absolutely. So the data is fairly clear that urban economies, city-based economies, if you will, account for about 75% of global GDP. But by the same token, these same cities account for 80% of CO2 emissions. Cities are clearly the engine room of the global economy, but they're also the primary
driver. And are hurtling us towards our destruction.
Exactly.
You speak now about the specific South African context in terms of the powers of city government, but I just wanted to take a step back. Obviously, another differentiator is the our history of apartheid and the apartheid city, and I'm just always, I've spoken to
various people over the years on this podcast about urban planning, urbanization, and one of the constant themes is the difficulty in breaking down the legacy of the apartheid urban plan. How do you sort of place your research given that context and that very kind of specific sort of history of urbanization we have in South Africa? And what does that tell you about that process of urbanization and, I suppose, decolonization of the city, if I can put it that way?
Sure. Yeah, so, this is something, you know, that I've been working on and thinking about and reflecting on for an inordinately long time. I regret to confess. So I was, you know, preparing for this and sort of thinking through some of the prompts of your note. I realized, you know, that my sort of first thesis for my honors was very much about the attempts to reform local government at the urban scale in sort of late apartheid days. And then my PhD thesis was on why urban integration in the first 10 years of democracy has been so elusive and almost an impossible policy ideal. And then in 2017, 2018, you know, with this question being front and center in the context of Cape Town again, we had a specific incident where the provincial government was going to sell a parcel of land in Sea Point to a private developer.
Right.
And a network of social movements and NGOs in Cape Town, mobilized a campaign to prevent that and demonstrate that the benefits that could be had if that was developed for low-income workers who work in that part of the city but obviously have to travel 60-70 kilometers a day to get to work. And this caught the public's imagination in a very significant way. And what struck me in that standoff, if you will, between then Premier Zilla and the social movements was, you know, the extent to which it felt like deja vu, you know, the amount of times we've kind of had that conversation and we make very, very little progress, to be honest. So in response to that, I then decided I wanted to do something because I wanted to wrestle with a group of people as to, you know, why is it so hard to transform Cape Town and by extension other South African cities? And I then conceptualized and curated something called the Integration Syndicate. And we then brought together 25 leaders from different sectors, the private sector, social movements, the academy, and so on. And I designed a sort of monthly conversations over a period of 9 months where we would gather data, evidence, and then spend a whole afternoon in deliberation, and then we'd share a meal at the end of the evening together. And part of that was to recognize the different points we were coming from. So, for example, one of the private sector people was the head of property management for Old Mutual, and another private sector player was, sort of one of the emerging black property developers who just can't break into the market, because of the mafia-like structure in Cape Town. And so it was important to recognize that this is not just about policy or about the history of the long-term impacts of planning, but it's also about people speaking posh to each other, not having a shared language about where we're coming from, what's the drivers of spatial inequality, and, you know, what are the levers available for us to think through that. And it was fascinating. And what I then did at the end of that was we identified 5 provocations to shift the debate so that we don't just focus on land politics, but that we really understand there are multiple drivers to this. And at the heart of that, and I am sort of in a roundabout way coming to the core of your question, what through that process and the research we did and the conversations we had, the conclusion I arrived at was the biggest problem we face may be that we see cities that remain a sort of deeply segregated along race and class lines. But at the heart of that is what I would call a stunted social mobility of young people in our cities. And what do I mean by this? That if you are born in a township, in formal settlement or a former council house or RTP house, whatever, and you're Black, you are going to be confronted with three structural problems. One, economic exclusion. You know, even if you finish matric, you're unlikely to get a formal job. You're going to probably end up having some kind of hustle in the informal economy. Secondly, you're going to be subject to a very bad education system, which will ill-equip you for the labor market and for, you know, sort of employment that will allow you to progress, economically speaking. And you will also, you know, suffer from poor health. Because of just the limitations of our healthcare system. But those two sort of, if you will, well understood drivers of social exclusion, I think has a third dimension, which is not spoken about, which is cultural erasure. In other words, your identity as a young person is continuously undermined. There's no representation in the society that, you know, people with your body and history succeed, and you don't know where you belong. You know, are you supposed to be this person immersed in your rural identity, or, you know, what? Because the city, in terms of all its opportunities, is not available to you. And I think it is the way in which that undermines confidence and self-belief that is such an important part of why economic exclusion and, you know, and poor education conspire to reproduce stunted social mobility. Now, of course, this is always spatially concentrated, right? It means your life world and your imagination is the street in the township, right? It's whatever is mediated by social media in terms of, you know, whether it's, you know, hip-hop culture or global consumerism and so on. So those are the poles that you have to live in, and within that there's very little that is gonna allow you, you know, I would say for 90% of Black youth, you know, they won't have the possibility of finding a future in the city that is going to be different to where they were born. And so unless we understand, you know, those underlying drivers, we can talk until we're blue in the face about specific parcels of land in former white areas or about planning, but it's a much more profound and a much deeper question. So, you know, so we have to recognize the sort of generational nature of what apartheid planning has produced over time. Yeah. It's not just about planning. It's a much more insidious and widespread phenomena across society. And it requires a set of responses that can deal with all of those dimensions, right? Just focusing on a residential mix, you know, is just not going to cut it in our society. So I don't know if that's an answer, but that's kind of where my head is at. And just in parenthesis, I mean, you know, to try and shift the debate, you know, that whole process of the integration syndicate and the findings and our recommendations and so on, we put together in a publication that I edited last year, and that's available for free download on our ACC website. So I'm very happy for your listeners to explore that on their own time.
I would definitely like to have a look. Is that called the Integration Syndicate, or what is the document called?
Yes, the book is called the Integration Syndicate, and it's got a subtitle which is too long for a podcast.
No, that's fine. No, that sounds, it's almost sounds like you had your own little TRC, your mini TRC there with the
Integration Syndicate
to try and look beyond the same old tropes of the discussion about money and or I suppose getting back to the same old tropes of money and power, not looking at it at a much broader level, and again bearing in mind the legacy of apartheid that I think so many people seem to want to forget, or at least not confront in the way that perhaps is necessary. I was just wondering, so if it's I mean, because that is then a massive I mean, you kind of just blew my mind there a little bit, because that you're talking about a transformation in sort of socioeconomic philosophies, thinking, but maybe at a more local, immediate level, mm-hmm. what role can transport, I've been mm-hmm. thinking about taxis yeah. and whether they're a good thing or a bad thing, and yeah. and sort of the lack of, I mean, you look at cities like, okay, the older European cities, and even certain cities in Latin America and Asia that have developed more sort of recently modern public transport system, monorails, undergrounds, trams, uh-huh. et cetera, et cetera. A lot of those sort of European cities built their, which are large infrastructural projects in any context, many, many, even centuries ago. So the, you know, the cost benefit now is much more, I suppose, than it would be immediately seen today. I'm just thinking, is a massive restructuring and rethinking of transport and public transport a way to close the gap in our urban yeah. spaces?
No, absolutely. So, in fact, you know, as I suggested earlier, so instead of just doing a diagnostic of the, let's say, the neo-apartheid urban condition, what we tried to do was to put forward five propositions that were what we believed implementable, but will have in combination a transformative effect on South African cities. And one of those was about transport. So I'll very quickly walk you through that.
Sure, please.
I'd so like we to hear that. So what we argue is that we've got a very peculiar set of dynamics in the mobility space, and in a way we just bear with me, but what we argue is that we've solved the mobility problem, but we just don't know it yet. We can't admit it to ourselves. So what we mean by that is that we've got as you know, with the World Cup, we decided we're going to learn from Latin America, and we're going to introduce these bus rapid transit systems because they're cheaper than underground metros, but they, in theory, you know, could have the same efficiency.
Quickly.
Exactly. Yeah. The problem is that we in the modeling, they forgot that we have inherited this incredibly low spatial density urban form. And for those modes to be economically viable, you need urban densities along those corridors, which is 5 to 8 times what our average densities are in Johannesburg, Cape Town, and Durban. Huh. So it was never going to be viable, right? Because
we
just
can't. You're saying there's just not enough people to use.
Yes, exactly. So basically, in Cape Town, the average density is 15 dwelling units per hectare. And for the BRT system to be viable on a trunk route, you'd need a minimum of 75 dwelling units per hectare.
And that's even if you completely remove the taxis.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. If you just remove the
good
taxis.
Good heavens.
So because, you know, those buses, just in terms of the CapEx you've got to invest, and of course the big cost driver there is actually the roads, because those red
yes.
dedicated lanes are, they're a very special kind of reinforced concrete. So they're extremely expensive to construct, apart from the disruptive effects that they have when you do the construction. So BRT was actually never going to work in our context because we just couldn't make the numbers work. So it's fine. Public transport should be subsidized, all good.
Yep,
sure. But of course, the point is, you know, what level of subsidy makes sense? So if you then look at rail, there, of course, we've just got one of the most extreme examples of state capture and all of the corruption associated with that. So we've allowed one of our prime backbone infrastructures to just go to ruins, basically. Exactly. And so, you know, so even though, so just 20 years ago, something like 40 to 45% of all daily trips were on rail in our big cities. That's are down to less than 10%, right? Now, here's the kicker. So we do give an enormous amount of public subsidy to rail, to buses. You remember buses beyond the BRTs and
yes.
the BRT systems.
Just the metro buses.
Just the metro buses, exactly. And those subsidies are guaranteed, right? So those companies have a fixed income irrespective of how many people they move. So that's another story for another day. But anyway, the point is we spend, sort of in the tens of billions per annum in South Africa on public transport subsidies.
However,
the only sector that is a wholly black-owned economic sector, the minibus taxi industry, they don't see a cent of the subsidy regime, even though they have organically responded to the urban form of South African cities. So what the census data tells us is that no one in a big city in South Africa has to walk for more than 15 minutes, irrespective of whether you live in Orange Farm or at the far outskirts of the city, to get a minibus taxi. Now, that is incredible. That's what I mean, we've solved public transport. We've solved the access issue. What we haven't solved is modernizing that organic response. And what does that mean? We've got to bring them into the net. We've got to create an integrated system where the subsidies are shared. We cut a deal with the taxi industry where we say to them, we will expand the recap program of 10 years ago so that you can all install digital sensors in your taxis. Put seatbelts on every seat. We do speed control. Your drivers go on training courses, blah, blah, blah. Yes, you will now pay tax, but we will double your market share in 10 years' time as a public-private partnership. So you make a lot more money, your workers get a minimum wage, and the citizens can have a predictive public transport solution.
Yes, it becomes a scheduled service, so because people will know when they're going to get to work, when they have to leave.
It's all mediated through your phone. And then, of course, for good measure, you can make those apps cost-free, right? So even if people have a dumb phone or a smartphone, they don't pay for the data costs to be able to interact with that service. Now, that is not rocket science. It's not uncomplicated. I'm not a transport engineer, but I've spoken to quite a few of them. The reason we can't achieve that is because we have a fragmented system at the moment. So the subsidies are administered by national government and provincial government. The entity responsible for integrated public transit planning are city governments, but they've got none of the resources at their disposal to regulate the players. And then, of course, provinces do the traffic management and licensing for minibus taxis. So you first have to, one, agree on the vision, two, sort out the mess in terms of who's responsible for what, and then have political leadership that can go and do the tough negotiations with the organized taxi industry. Now, my reading is, you know, they are business people. If they see a viable business plan, they can see, you know, sort of a fairly reliable income projections and so forth. There is just no way that they are going to turn this down. But it needs coherence, leadership, and so forth. So, you know, so when I see what is happening now in Gauteng and with the proposed strike and the debates on, you know, the bailout and all of that, you know, these are all things that are totally preventable, because if there's one sector that can have a massive knock-on effect to improve the efficiencies of our cities and deal with some of the segregation and fragmentation, it's public transport. And actually, it is totally, totally resolvable.
Amazing. Yeah, that's fascinating, because I just I just wrote here taxis, blessing or curse, because at the moment, even though they're kind of the fundamental driver of an urban economy, there's just it just seems to be still too complicated. People wanting to travel from one side of Johannesburg to the other still need to take three or four taxis in order to do that. They don't know when the taxi's going to arrive or leave. There's no kind of control of from the passenger side on their journey. And then I was thinking, you know, it's amazing that to this day there's been no recognition of urban planning, road planners in particular, of the existence of why are there not taxi stops integrated into bus stops? Why are there not lay-bys built into the streets? Okay, you can build the odd taxi rank here and there, but why don't we make like taxi stops on main routes where passengers congregate, so you don't have taxis stopping every 30 meters to pick up a person after a person after a person. Yeah. It becomes like a bit more structured. Obviously, that would also, as you say, you talk about integration and leadership on the government yeah. side. It would also require
yeah.
quite a massive leap in imagination from the taxi ownership as well, in terms of exactly as you say, actually yeah. having employees that they would have registered and pay sort of taxable income to, etc., mm-hmm. etc. Mm-hmm. But as, I mean, the way you put it, that yeah. seems Look, to be something that's not insurmountable. But
No, it's a couple of billion rand industry, right? And yeah. so, you know, this is the one example. There's a lot of stuff in the urban space, particularly housing and land markets, that's very complex. But this is the one issue where, for me, a win-win solution is completely feasible. And, you know, and if you apply a bit of gaming theory, it's not difficult to see what the solutions are here. Mm. But, you know, we, at the moment, you know, there isn't the political, I mean, to be blunt, you know, for the longest time, we've not had political leadership or policy imagination
on the part of government. Yeah, imagination is always a word that I conjure up in these sort of situations. You mentioned, I'm not sure, can we touch on those other
Yes, absolutely.
Four points
housing
that came out of the integration syndicate. Just take me through them as bullet points, and then I can see where I want to follow up or not.
No. I'm happy to do that. So we had five, and what we were trying to achieve with this was to, you know, sort of explain what the different dimensions are of kind of really thinking through a societal response. Yeah, that works with a policy framework. So the first was immobility, which I've talked you through. Then on the housing question, which is really vexed, you know, essentially what we said was the main driver of real estate is actually the public sector because of the amount that we spend per annum on RTP housing. So the value of what the private sector delivers on an annual basis is, of course, 10 times the market value of public housing, but the quantum of what the state delivers is 10 times more than what the private sector builds on an annual basis.
In terms of the people that are housed,
in terms of the people and the number of units. So you're looking at about the government delivers between 160 to 200,000 units per annum. The private sector brings about 20 to 30,000 new stock into the market per annum.
Yeah.
So, but the value of the private stock is much higher, obviously.
Sure. It's a bungalow on Clifton Beach or an office block in the middle of the city versus a couple of houses out
in RDP house in the middle of nowhere. But that the subsidy system, the way that works is that the subsidy's got to cover the cost of the land and the top structure and the connecting infrastructure. So that's why these settlements get built in the middle of nowhere, because the land is the cheapest there. And that's really what has been the primary driver of reproducing the apartheid spatial form, and why the urban poor is the furthest away from economic opportunities. Of course, the irony of that is that because people are further away, to get infrastructure to them is a lot more expensive for the government. Right, so that's the paradox of the government's housing policy. But housing leads infrastructure investments in South Africa. So what we propose is that the provocation is you put a moratorium on urban sprawl. In other words, you don't build a single public house at the outskirts of the city. You only build on infill pockets. Where are those infill pockets? Interestingly enough, if we reimagine public school grounds, you can do 2-3-story walk-ups at the edges of these. Because that reintegrates schools with communities. You can put all kinds of community level facilities there, laundromats, car repair shops, ECDs, et cetera, et cetera. You can have older people live on the ground floor. They can be part of taking care of children playing in the afternoon in the interface between the school and these blocks and so on. So we've modeled it out. That allows you to do medium density housing. You can integrate these communities. You can bring greater safety to the public schools. And you can have a completely different set of relationships between schools and communities. Secondly, you can also do, you can take, so we've got an oversupply of parks and green spaces in the suburbs because of the apartheid planning history.
I thought you were going to say golf courses.
That too, that too. I include golf courses in that. And there's no reason why you can't do. So what we did was we generated a set of typologies and we illustrate them in the book, as you'll see when you download it, to show what's possible in Claremont next to Saks. What, for, as housing for security guards, gardeners, cleaners, etc., etc. So you can see, if you look at the scale of the need, how much you can build per annum in South Africa because of the size of the market and public money. We've got enough infill land to keep us busy with housing construction, but completely different typologies for the next 20 years. So for 20 years, we don't need to do sprawl. We just need to completely reimagine and re-engineer the construction process, but understand that actually housing is about building communities. It's not about providing just providing a roof over
somebody's head. It's an integrated kind of thinking around.
Exactly. Yeah. So you've got to do a whole bunch of other things for people to, if you will, be willing to live differently.
Well, live so, in apartment blocks, or live above ground.
And then, you know, we also then have some ideas about how you can then, for those who can't afford or are on a waiting list, who are forced to be in informal settlements, how one can also upgrade the quality of the shacks using public employment programs. And you can, we've also then, we cite an example where you can take alien vegetation that has been repurposed as a building material, and that has now already been approved by the Bureau of Standards of South Africa. And that lends itself to labor-intensive, non-mechanical construction techniques. Now, if you look at Latin America or Asia, the way they've been able to consolidate their what they call popular neighborhoods or slums over time is that they've standardized the construction materials for informal settlements. They had very minimal building regulation standards that were monitored by communities themselves, so that over time, what started off as a shack in fact becomes a house, a 2-, 3-, 4-story house. And these communities build local economies around this industry of construction, repair, supplying building materials, doing carpentry, doing electrical work, and so on.
Right.
There's absolutely no reason why we can't do the same, especially given, you know, the dearth of employment opportunities and so forth, and the absence of economic life in a lot of informal settlement contexts. So that's what we say around housing. The third aspect that we talk about, which is related to that, is what we call placemaking through public works. And this is where we provide a menu of all of the public space and cultural services that a healthy community needs, and how you can think of that as mechanisms for the public employment, public works program, and the community works program. These are existing government initiatives.
Right, yeah.
How these can be connected with placemaking. So if you can restore green spaces, if you can restore wetlands, if you can create safety in the available park spaces, repair the play areas, etc., through an ongoing program of construction and repair, but that is part of a community plan, you can dramatically improve safety and the quality of the living environment outside of people's homes in the township environment. And our proposition is that that is the catalyst you need for economic activity to thrive as well. So the fourth aspect is really focused on young people, and it comes back to where
that
I started
point.
Off earlier, this point about your lack of identity and so on.
Cultural
so what we
erasure.
Propose is that, exactly, is that we have to restore the capacity amongst our youth to tell their own stories and their own narratives. So what we propose in the book is that at schools, we form journalism clubs. And these journalism clubs will basically train high school kids or young people to, you know, the basic techniques of storytelling, basic techniques of, ironically, given that we're on a podcast, podcasting, and then encourage them to go to their streets, to their relatives, to their families, and so on, and recover their own cultural histories. And And what we believe that will do is that it creates a platform on which you can then, following the work of the Community Radio Foundation, you can bring together young people from different class backgrounds in the city, and they can exchange with each other and learn how to put radio programs together with these cultural narratives that they've produced themselves. So in the book, we kind of set out the provocation, but we then also demonstrate what the curriculum could look like, how you could mainstream this across all high schools, et cetera, et cetera. The last provocation in the book is then really kind of thinking through that network systems approach to community development that is driven by young people and their energy, is to take again the work, and in all of these provocations, what we try to do was to look at what's already emergent. So this is not ideas from our heads, but these are little experiments that, you know, green shoots, that's already there.
Right.
And the last one we call Solidarity Switchboard, and this is where we've looked at something in Elsie's River in Cape Town, and another project called R Labs, where they created sort of these fascinating digital hubs where former prisoners, unemployed youth are being given exposure to very basic IT skills. And also these serve almost as spaces where people can come and prepare a CV, they get a bit of airtime to look for work opportunities and so on. But what struck us about that is that actually these nodes also service a whole bunch of local civil society organizations with basic back-end computer support. They support cultural groups with to do recordings of music and so on. And, you know, so they kind of become these
little
hubs
cultural,
of enormous...
cultural centers almost.
So we sort of imagined, you know, what if, because all of our cities, of course, are talking about smart cities and blah, blah, broadband access, blah, blah, blah. So what we said is, what if you invest in community, these little nodes in all of the neighborhoods across the city, and they then provide a digital network through which young people can connect with each other and a whole bunch of things. And also, you know, what I've always been struck by was the desperation amongst middle classes to know how to access opportunities to contribute, you know, skills, time, resources, effort.
Right.
And what these things could do, and that's the switchboard idea, is that they can create the platforms for apps where people can, you know, sort of through volunteering and other ways, connect into local organizations in the poorer parts of the city. And because unless we get that sort of cross-class human interaction where people work shoulder to shoulder on specific things, you're never going to change the cultural divides in our cities, right? And I use the word cultural divides, and I'm not saying racial divides, because I think we need to recognize that the cleavages between, for example, colored and African black communities are as profound and toxic as it is between white and black, right? And the same applies to Indian communities and so on. So as a society, we are so overwrought with our, you know, with our multiple divisions that, you know, we really need to, through practice, I think, and through sort of very physical, tactile doing things together, rediscover each other and begin to build a different cultural fabric. And that's not going to happen, you know, automatically. So that was the last provocation, is to kind of connect the digital opportunities of the moment with enriching
the human
societal
experience.
Infrastructures. And so those are the five areas that we explore.
It's absolutely fascinating, Edgar. I must say, I'm definitely going to look into that. And that's, I mean, that's really encapsulated, I suppose, just what you're trying to achieve, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's obviously, you know, because a lot of my work over the last 15 years has been international. So I've been doing a lot of advisory work with the UN and other development bodies. I really felt, the need. So sort of what prompted this actually was that, and maybe something to just mention as of interest is, you know, even one of the things that I try and do with ACC is that we try and also break the mold of academic research. So from the beginning, we've been really focused on how do we communicate with society and how do we stimulate new publics, new communities of interest around the things that we work on. And so, you know, so I've been experimenting with one of my collaborators, his name is Tao Tavengwa, and one of our projects is a magazine called Cityscapes.
Yes.
That looks at, you know, sort of issues in the urban issues in the global south using photography and narrative and so on. But we've also curated a number of exhibitions. And so in 2014-15, Tao and I did an exhibition on Cape Town using the research of ACC, but we wanted to translate that research into formats that spoke to a larger public, right, and kind of engaged public discourse and debate. And it was really on the back of that work and how it found resonance or did not that, you know, sort of, and some of the developments, as I mentioned earlier, happening in the public sphere in Cape Town, that I felt the integration syndicate was called for.
Hmm.
But a big part of that was also, you know, sort of I needed to immerse myself in my own backyard because I was doing this very high sort of falutin and very sort of a macro work, you know,
right,
looking at global, a sort of urbanization at a global scale,
yeah,
and engaging sort of the SDGs and the, you know, the climate change stuff and so on.
Yes.
And I really felt a bit removed
from the ground.
Exactly. And I needed a counterpoint to that.
Yeah.
And so, you know, so yes, it's very much part of what ACC does and the way that I work.
Yeah.
But part of it is that, you know, we have to always think and work across these levels.
Yes.
That's kind of, which is wonderful at one level, because obviously it's incredibly stimulating, but it's also unbelievably hard and demanding, right?
Yeah.
Because the dynamics and the
things
you've got to pay attention to at these different scales are very, very different.
Cogs in the machine that need to be oiled or removed, I suppose, one way or the other. It's absolutely fascinating. We need to end up. To come to an end. I just wanted to. I've read somewhere you talk about responsive design and adaptive governance systems.
Yes.
Could you maybe just?
Sure.
We could just finish up on perhaps if you could just expand a little bit on those two concepts and what they mean, how they fit into this kind of adaptive urbanism that you're trying to implement or practice.
Sure. No, so this was just, you know, again, as a way of connecting research, politics, and policy debates. So what has happened in the last 10 years is that, especially in the African context, a lot of African governments have started to produce what they call national urban policies or plans. But a lot of that has also created a market for the global consultancy firms like McKinsey, Siemens, and so on, to punt that digital solutions or sort of framed as smart cities is the answer to Africa's problems. So this is extremely problematic because at best 10 to 15% of populations in African cities can afford these solutions, and all it will do is to exacerbate pre-existing inequalities.
Right.
So what we've done is to build a framework where we say, yes, let's be open to digital innovation and technological solutions, but we have to recognize that your starting point is the solutions that African dwellers have produced themselves to compensate for the lack of public sector investment and access to basic services and so forth. And once you understand the detail of people's ingenuity, that technology, if you will, is almost more important than the digital stuff. So the adaptive city is about taking what the urban poor and sort of have invented and created themselves to survive in these very harsh conditions, and combining that with the possibilities of technology and smart regulation, sort of smart policy making. But that requires very different forms of local government, city government, different forms of intergovernmental relations, and different kinds of leadership. And that's what we call adapt, you know, the capacity to
adaptive governance.
So I've kind of tried to both theorize and document what this might be. And at the moment, I'm working with a wonderful think tank called Dark Matter Lab and the UNDP in the Africa region to work with a bunch of cities who is willing to experiment with these things. And that's sort of a big part of my work over the next few years, is to really sort of work in quite a grounded way with different cities who say we want to be adaptive, we want to experiment, and we will then do that in open source format so that we can document it, and then that can hopefully be disseminated and adopted by others as quickly as possible.
Fascinating. Is Kigali one of those cities, by the way?
So it won't be in this frame, but I have visited Kigali and I pay quite close attention to what they do. And it is really interesting and fascinating and complicated, but way too long for this conversation. We'll have to pick that up on another time.
I visited, in another lifetime, I visited Kigali, and there was a lot of talk of smart city projects, etc.
And they very much positioning themselves to be the African leader in that space. Mm. And so they've created an interesting institutional ecosystem around that. Mm. And, you know, typical Rwandese style, it's also very much part of the president's geopolitical positioning on the continent and so on.
Yeah.
But not to say there isn't substance. Mm. I think it is too formalized, and I think it is too beholden to these frameworks that these global players bring into the continent, and it's not sufficiently adapted to the local conditions. But, you know, I'm happy to be proven wrong, and I do follow what they do very closely.
Now, I mean, I suppose that is one of the critiques of the smart cities concept, is it goes completely against what you're talking about, which is kind of a bottom-up approach to that and trying to get the two the technology and the people to meet kind of halfway, as opposed to a more top-down, just putting a solution in place, putting a square peg, a square peg into a round hole or whatever.
Yeah, exactly.
Edgar, that's been a fascinating conversation. I hope I was kind of making sense from my end.
No, completely. I hope I wasn't too wordy. I was trying to be as concise as possible.
I do try and prepare a little bit for these discussions, but obviously sometimes it is a little bit out of my sort of basic remit. But that was very, very stimulating for me, just to, I think particularly on the public transport question, I think that was just a mind-blowing sort of take on the potential and the possibility of transforming public transport in South Africa with a kind of ready-made solution, if I can put it that way. It would be interesting, I think, it would be interesting, I think, for us to talk maybe in a year or two's time about how COVID will impact on urban planning and urban interaction.
We obviously have to we obviously have to engage this question in ACC, and you know we are. I've got two webinars next month or later this month with our partners on the continent to just listen, hear what's happening on the ground in their cities, what's the planning responses, et cetera, et cetera. So a big part of what we're just trying to do for the remainder of this year is to just listen and to speak to our colleagues and to try and make sense of things, and then try and see. Hopefully this opens up space for more ambition and for governments to be a bit more serious.
I was thinking, my first thought was really a proper housing program, a fast-moving urban housing program.
The big thing is, and of course, sort of just the issues around water and sanitation has been obviously, that's just been made abundantly clear, just what a disaster that is across the continent, and how that undermines the possibility of stemming the
disease,
pandemic.
So
we'll see. Yeah. We'll see.
It's an incredible space you're in. I must say, just you're at the cusp of an incredible innovation and just dynamic possibilities. I suppose I'm
Yeah, I hope so. I mean, it feels like that to me. I'm not sure it always makes that much sense to people outside of the field. But yeah, that's certainly how it feels very to me special. And why I love the work, you know. So,
once again, Edgar, appreciate it. It's been a pleasure speaking to you. And
same. Take care. Yeah. Thanks for the opportunity. Okay, bye. Cheers, man. Bye.
That did cover a lot of ground, excuse the pun. I hope you enjoyed that. There was a lot to take in there, and it's clear, as he says, that there's a lot to be done. You know, he described his work as both being inspiring and exhausting. And you get a sense of the different, as we mentioned, the sort of different cogs, the different layers, the different levels that are all working together and sometimes against each other when it comes to this chaotic process of urbanization. I was particularly intrigued by his thoughts around the taxi industry and how one could formally integrate this seemingly chaotic and yet so vital an industry into a sort of broader public transport network in South Africa. And then also the ongoing challenges of the generational, of breaking down the generational impact of apartheid planning that still haunts our cities today on so many levels. Please download the Integration Syndicate book that was produced from the sessions that took place. You can go to www.africancenterforcities.net/isbook. I'll post a link on the page as well. Wash your hands, wear a mask, keep your distance, stay indoors as much as possible. Thanks again to Hindenburg for their support. Hindenburg software is designed for radio journalism and podcasting and is practical and easy to use. Go to hindenburg.com for more information and sign up for a free trial. You may subscribe to Voices from SA via Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Audioboom, Radio Public, Deezer, or indeed wherever you get your podcasts. Tell your colleagues, tell your friends, tell the world. Until next time, I'm Nicholas Claude. Cheers.